Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what centuries-old traditional method was used to finance the publication of the second issue of Journal for Diasporic Hebrew? Tal Hever-Hibovsky grew up in Jerusalem and obtained a Bachelor of Arts in History from the Hebrew University. In 2008, he moved to Berlin, where he received an MA and PhD in History at Humboldt University. He learned Yiddish in Vilnius and Paris, and he became the director of the House of Yiddish Culture Medem Library in Paris in September 2014. In 2017, he directed their first Yiddish summer program in Berlin, which he told us about in a previous program. Tal is also the founder and editor-in-chief of Mikan Ve'elach, Journal for Diasporic Hebrew, which he's speaking with us about this week. I'd like to thank you for speaking with us. And could you first tell us a little bit about your own background, where you're from, where you've lived?
Of course. So I was born in the United States. In California, and grew up, most of my life, I grew up in Jerusalem. And at the age of 21, more or less, I moved to Berlin. It was 2008, and I stayed there for 6-7 years with some pauses. I had a 1 year in Geneva, a short period in New York, and then 2014, I moved to Paris for a job, basically, to direct the Paris City Center, Medem Library.
What made you come to Berlin?
What made me come to Berlin? I think I was infatuated with the city, in a way. I came here 2007 just to learn German, which also I decided to learn German completely by chance. I started to learn French in the university, and the teacher was not very good, so I switched to German, and the teacher said that there are scholarships for learning German in Germany, and I applied for one and got it, and then went to Berlin. And then after 2 months, I felt that I have found a very good place to live in. So for me, it was clear that I would like to try to live here. Yeah.
So you've been in Europe for many years. What connections do you still have with Israel?
So I don't know. Maybe we should talk a bit about the word Israel. May I? I mean, a lot of time before the interview, you spoke about Israel in Israel. For me, it's very important to emphasize that the name Israel is a very old name that signified the Jews for at least 2,000 years. So when people ask me about my connection to Israel, for me the answer is I am Israel. I am a Jew. I believe that by your question you were referring to the state of Israel or to the land of Israel, to the citizenship of being Israeli, etc., which for me are secondary. These kinds of parts of my identity are interesting historically. Of course, I speak a certain variety of Hebrew, which is also a very old language, but today is mostly known through a certain variety of it, which I speak for. And I have some family who lives in a state that is called the State of Israel, but for me the connection to Israel is a much deeper, more historical. I would call it Isol, Israel. Right?
No, what I actually really meant was something a lot less profound. I mean, you grew up there, and you left as an adult when you were 21. So what I meant was connections to the place that you grew up in.
So I think that the connections are mainly in the head. I mean, these are memories. They are interesting memories, parts of who I am. But these, of course, are not to be retrieved. These belong to the past, which is true for every person, I think. This is not the place where I live today. This is not the place in which I engage in work or in cultural activity, these kind of things that I do. on a day-to-day basis, but it is a place of the past for me. It is a place of memory, not so much of nostalgia, more of memory, understanding that most of who I am comes from a certain growing up in a certain place, in a certain environment, and of course it plays a major role in who am I today. I still have a mother in Jerusalem who comes very often to Europe, but besides her I have distant relatives, but most of my family has also moved shortly after I did. So I have two brothers here in Germany, and my father lives in New Haven in the United States. He teaches at Yale University. So the family has somehow relocated in a way since 2008. And today, for example, when we think of where to host the Seder, the Passover, then Berlin is a much more appropriate center for my family than any place else, for example.
So tell us about the journal in Hebrew that you have created for, I understand, Israelis in the diaspora.
So the journal is actually created for Hebrew, not so much for a reader as much as for a language. We can talk about it later. It is anyway defined as Journal for Diasporic Hebrew. That is the byline. Mm-hmm. So when I came here in 2008, I was confronted with a question, a personal question. What am I going to do with my own language? For me, Hebrew was something, it is the case for many Israelis, was something that is completely bound to the territory of the state of Israel. And in Germany, it had only a very minor pertinence to the place where I chose to live in. And my first reflex, and I think that was the reflex of many Jews before me, from Heinrich Heine until, well, I don't want to compare myself to them, but this reflex of just assimilating, converting, or, I mean, in their case, not in my case. In my case, it was a certain desire at the beginning, a desire to get rid of my particular culture, to deem it unimportant and irrelevant to the place in which I chose to live. I'm now moving to Berlin, so I should immerse myself in German and become a German of sort.
Yeah, but that's contradictory to what you said before about how your being from Israel is such an integral part of you.
It is very contradictory, because this is the beginning of a process that soon changed. Very soon I realized that this kind of rejection of my own identity or my own culture is a sort of a self-hate, is a sort of a wish to become somebody else, which in a sense I think it's natural to want to be somebody else. But what I came to realize is that I have a part of myself that is not going anywhere. And I need to find, what am I going to do with it? What am I going to fill it with? Or how am I going to use it to fill something else? And then the question became much more clear for me. What is the relation of Hebrew to the place in which I chose to live? Or in other questions, what is the, in other terms, sorry, what is the Hebrew of Europe? Which later was pronounced a bit more precisely, the Hebrew of Ashkenaz. What is this Hebrew that is here now, right now, because I speak it, even though it's the Israeli variety, it is Hebrew and it is spoken here in Germany, here in Europe, but it has an history, because my grandmother, who grew up in Shedlitz, not far away from Warsaw, she also went to Hebrew school, and she spoke fluent Hebrew when she was here. And generations before that, Hebrew always meant something to my family, and Hebrew always meant something to this continent. And the search of what I came to term as diasporic Hebrew, the search for this diasporic Hebrew, is the, let's say, the framework in which the journal Mikan Velach was invented or was created, right? The journal itself is a representation of this journey. This journal is more about the question that it poses than about clear answers. It's not a manifest of sort. It's not some kind of a program of how to change Jewish or Hebrew culture in the diaspora. It's more a quest of trying to identify and to find traces, both in the past, but also in the future and in the present, of Hebrew here in the diaspora. This is why the journal in English, the name, the translation is Journal for Diasporic Hebrew, not of Diasporic Hebrew. It is for Diasporic Hebrew. There's a certain hope, a certain expectation, etc.
So tell us when you created it and exactly what it consists of and who participates, both as writers and as readers.
So the journal took a very long time to ripen. The work began in 2009. At the time, I was not sure what kind of journal it's going to be. At the time, it was more of a magazine, something maybe for immigrants with practical information on what they should do, how they should get along in Germany, etc. And gradually, through a period of 7 years, from 2009 until 2016, when the first issue came to being, the journal became, I would say, much broader in its aims and also much profounder in its breadth. So, first of all, it has started here in Berlin, but it soon became interested in this kind of Hebrew culture as a minority culture, as a language very much like Yiddish, that does not have sovereignty, that is not the major language of a certain place, but a minor language, as it was for thousands of years, not only in Berlin, but in all of its places, as a language also that can connect people from different places. And this also has brought me to Yiddish, precisely this kind of search for a configuration of a language that is not bound to one territory, that is not bound to power structures of a state, but rests on a literature, on a culture, on a shared literature and culture that is shared among people living in very different places. So from 2009, when the idea was to create some kind of a Berlin-based magazine in Hebrew, to 2016, where it was launched parallelly in Paris and in Berlin as a journal that is aimed to find representations or to give a platform to the very wide and abstract notion of diasporic Hebrew, you can see a very big change. My ideas in 2009 were not my ideas in 2010 and 11 and so on and so on. It's still, I hope, a project in development, a project in progress. We have not found the answer to all of these questions, but we try to pose them.
Well, it's good for a project to keep evolving anyway, and rather than being static and dead, I think.
Precisely. I don't like the word dead that much, but it's maybe my sensitivity. But absolutely.
Okay, stagnant.
Yeah. I agree completely. I think that it loses its importance once it feels that it has found its right place and it becomes major again, right? The position of being a minor journal or serving a minor purpose or serving, not a minor purpose, but serving a minority consciousness and not trying to gain power, not trying to have the upper hand, right? This kind of attitude, I think, is essential to this kind of dynamism and openness, right? That you don't find once a certain movement establishes itself already as something clearly defined, and then you see all of these power structures and everybody who is heretic is suppressed and marginalized, so the mainstream agenda would prevail, right? So
So you have already mentioned that Hebrew has been an important language for the Jewish people for thousands of years all over the world. Would you say that most of the people who are involved in the journal, either as writers or as readers, are people who came originally from Israel with Hebrew as their native language, or people who have always lived in the diaspora but spoke Hebrew as a kind of a second language, a second language that happened to be Jewish?
So, as a matter of fact, it's the kind of people that were involved in the two first issues of the journal that came out in 2016 and 2017, this year. If you look at their biographies, you see that a great deal of them are non-Israeli Jews who know Hebrew for various reasons. A lot of them are Israeli immigrants who decided to live in Europe, mostly some in the US, some in other places, and non-Jews also who decided to learn Hebrew for various reasons. So it's not clearly you. There are also writers who reside in Tel Aviv. There is an author that published a fantastic text here in the last issue of 2017, and he's a Hebrew writer living in Tel Aviv. He's not excluded. But if you look at the kind of, if you look at the table of contents and you search a bit and you try to see who is who, then you certainly see that it's not the typical kind of writers who participate in the journal. But, and this is a very important point, there was absolutely no criteria that have anything to do with the biographies of the authors. Nobody who participated in those first issues and also in the future has was asked to live in a certain place or to have a certain biography, right? Nobody was asked whether they're Jewish or not Jewish or live in the state of Israel or live in the diaspora, etc., etc. What was the criteria or the most important criterion was the kind of intention that you find in the text itself, which I will explain if I may. What I was looking for, the text that I wanted to publish in the journal, both prose, poetry, and essays, the kind of Hebrew that I was looking for is a Hebrew that imagines a reader that is diasporic. Imagines a reader that is everywhere. So it's not so much about where the text comes from, in like where its author comes from, but to where it points. Whether the text takes into account the possibility that people from all around the world are going to read it, or whether, as most texts written in Hebrew today, takes it for granted that it's going to be read in a very precise location, in a very restricted geography. This is precisely the kind of thing that this journal was trying to open, right? So naturally, this kind of criterion has led the journal to pick texts by authors who also are scattered themselves, who live in various places. But this was not. This was never a criterion for choosing the text, the biography. It was never a criterion.
Are other people involved in the production of this journal, and where are they? Are they all in Paris with you, or are they in other places as well?
So the great majority of colleagues and co-editors and writers and translators work on the journal. It's a big group of people. The great majority live in Berlin and in Paris. This is our the two cities in which the journal is based, but a lot of them also live elsewhere. Of course, today the kind of redactional work that you can do using the internet allows you to create this kind of works not in a cafe or in a closed room, but online, which of course allows it also to be more diasporic in that sense. But I would certainly say that the overwhelming majority of contributors live in Europe, and the majority live in Paris and in Berlin.
Do you have any idea about who your readers are? First of all, how do people come to know about it? Where is it available if someone wants to buy it? And do you have any idea about the profile of your readers, who they are?
So actually, I do, for two reasons. First of all, the selling of the journal is done mostly online, and you see the addresses to which it should be sent. There's the fee is always the same. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, it always costs the same. The shipping cost, that was also a symbolic choice to make a journal that would ship itself equally and democratically to any kind of place, to everywhere in the world. So each time somebody has ordered the journal, and the first issue has sold approximately 500 copies, then you see what kind of people are ordering the journal. And for me, the fascinating thing to notice was how it is completely spread. So you have, like, if you look at the map of the people I created for myself, a kind of map to see where the readers are, where the buyers are, and you see it is scattered throughout the entire United States and Canada, throughout Western Europe, but also some in Eastern Europe, and basically from some in Australia, here and there. I have one by North Africa, but the majority is precisely where Jews live today, and not necessarily in the state of Israel. Of course, there are a lot of buyers also from the state of Israel, but they are certainly the minority of the readership. Actually, I believed when I this is an, something that surprised me when I started to work in the journal, when the first issue was published. I was sure that 90% of the buyers would come from the state of Israel, from Tel Aviv, from Jerusalem, etc. And I was very surprised to see that actually less than 10%. I think the interest there is not as big, because it's not precisely what it's not the kind of topics that they deal with there. They have other things to deal with, I guess. And now there's another indication to who are the readers. For the second issue, I tried to renew a tradition that was very widespread among Hebrew writers working in Europe since the 17th century, mostly. It's called prenumeranten, or pre-subscribers, at the time where Jews did not have the ability to go to a pub. There were no publishers, and Jews could not just go to a publisher and tell them, "Okay, so you are going to print 3,000 copies, and you'll distribute it." People had to gather money, to gather the capital in order to produce the book. So the authors themselves, they moved from town to town, and they made lists of pre-subscribers, were called in Yiddish, but also in Hebrew, they were called prenumeranten, pre-subscribers, who would give money upfront and their address, etc. And what I tried to do is recreate precisely the same gesture that is also diasporic, because you have the author that goes from town to town physically and creating all of these links and bridges between places, and relying on a readership and uniting it together through this kind of act of gathering. So we did that for the second issue, and there were 101 pre-subscribers. And according to tradition, the names of pre-subscribers are also printed in the book itself. So we did that as well, with the town or the city from which the pre-subscriber comes. It's also a traditional way to construct the list. You have Paris and all the names of the people. You have Lyon and all the names of the people, etc., etc. And there again, you see that the overwhelming majority of buyers are from Berlin. Then you have a very big amount of buyers, a lot of people coming from Paris, and then you see here and there and here and there Pittsburgh and Denver and that and here, and it's amazing to see how scattered it is.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from the readers?
So there are two kinds of feedbacks that I got. They are readers who wrote to me personally, and there were reviews that were printed both online and in printed newspapers in the state of Israel. So from readers, I have received a certain reaction that comes again and again. One reaction that is very, very common. People were very emotional about it and described the appearance of the journalist that happened mostly with the first issue as something that they have been waiting for. I'm speaking about readers, for example, who ex-Israelis who live in a town in Italy or in southern France or in Washington State for let's say 20 years and have had the same kinds of questions that I had with Hebrew. What is going to stay for them? What's going to be the relationship to Hebrew? And for them to receive this kind of journal that combines that unites them, that gives them, for some, a certain feel of purpose in connection to their language and culture, a certain validation of Hebrew, not only as a language that belongs to the state of Israel, which they decided to leave, but as a language that has validity and importance and can continue to produce and to be produced in throughout the world. I've received a lot of very emotional reactions, people thanking me and explaining how this allows them to feel much more secure about their language, about Hebrew. There are a lot of people, a lot of creators, a lot of writers who don't really know for whom they should write. I got a lot of very good texts from these kinds of people who saw the journal and thought, oh, now I found where I want to publish my work, because they didn't know where they should publish it, and then they saw here they could publish it, and they sent it, and it was published in the second issue. So this is one reaction. The second reaction I got was from Israeli newspapers, like reviews in literary supplements, and yeah, there was some criticism, a lot of questioning whether it is going to work or not. Could Hebrew exist outside of the bounds of the state of Israel? Which I think the question is relevant. It has, it does, and it will. But okay, so that is the question I think that is very central to a lot of the reviewers from Israel. But the reviews were mostly very generous, very, very positive. Underlining the intellectual achievement, underlining the depth of the intellectual work that has been done there in the essays section, also dealing with the literary sections in a mostly very generous and approving way. And I don't think that this approval is something that the journal needs. The journal needs readers, the journal needs writers, the journal needs a community, which it has, and I hope that it will at least remain and if not grow. I hope that it will also inspire others to do similar projects. And this kind of reviews, I mean, we didn't have any reviews by other diasporic Hebrew media outlets because there aren't other diasporic Hebrew media outlets. So the kind of reviews that we got was were from Israeli media. Yeah.
How often does it come out?
So there is no guarantee to that. It is also a symbolic choice. Most of the journals that came out here in Europe came out for one issue, two issues. You never know. This kind of precarity is part of this kind of cultural production. It's the same for Yiddish, right? This kind of cultural production that does not see itself already as powerful and strong and promising that now we're going to publish every day or every week, but knows that these ideas are something sometimes ephemeric, sometimes it's just for a certain period and it will go away, but the text will stay always. This is very important. I am aiming to produce one issue a year. So far we published the first issue in June 2016. The second issue in June 2017. So there's only hope that I will have enough material to publish an issue in June 2018.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirah.com. See you next week.